Network. This is Democracy Now!
The United States had to punish those responsible for these attacks.
There was no higher mission than finding Osama bin Laden.
The perpetrators of terrorism only understand the use of force.
They knew all along these major problems that were going to prevent us from winning.
No one even, like, really mentions 9/11 anymore. I mean, that, to me, that's the whole reason that I'm over here.
Any power without constraint always leads to abuse.
This week marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Today, a five-part Netflix documentary dives deep into the attacks, the response from the U.S., both at home and abroad. We'll speak with the filmmakers who interviewed survivors, U.S. officials, former CIA members, veterans, as well as soldiers in the Afghanistan National Army, Taliban commanders, and Afghan officials, warlords. Then we speak with Yale historian Samuel Moyne about his new book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War.
American war remains extremely violent, but during the last 20 years of the war on terror, a new kind of American war emerged that's more legalized, more humane, and endless. And as Joe Biden pulled troops from Afghanistan, he made clear that he plans to continue this new form of war, a counter-terrorist war that has extended in time and expanded in space and shows no signs of stopping anytime soon.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The World Health Organization called Wednesday for a global halt to third doses of COVID-19 vaccines for the rest of the year. WHO chief Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said wealthy nations should instead make limited vaccine supplies available to poorer countries.
We have been calling for vaccine equity from the beginning, not after the richest countries have been taken care of. I will not stay silent when the companies and countries that control the global supply of vaccines think the world's poor should be satisfied with leftovers.
The Biden administration's repeatedly rejected the WHO's calls to halt booster shots until medical workers and other at-risk groups can be vaccinated in poorer countries. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki spoke Wednesday.
Our view is that this is a false choice, and the United States has donated and shared about 140 million doses with over 90 countries, more than all other countries combined.
On Wednesday, UN officials said the COVAX initiative to bring vaccines to poor and middle-income nations was falling further behind its initial target of 2 billion doses this year. COVAX is now projecting about 1.4 billion doses delivered through December. Meanwhile, vaccine equity activists are cheering moves by Australia's government to support a suspension of intellectual property rights for COVID vaccines. Australia's trade minister said this week the government now supports calls for a temporary waiver of vaccine patent rights at the World Trade Organization. Such a move would require consensus at the WTO, where Germany and the United Kingdom are blocking the move to allow generic versions of vaccines produced by companies including Pfizer and Moderna. President Joe Biden is set to lay out his administration's six-point plan for managing the U.S. COVID-19 crisis. Biden's speech at 5 p.m. Thursday evening is expected to focus on ways businesses, schools, and government agencies can enact stricter policies on COVID vaccination and testing. The official U.S. coronavirus death toll has topped 650,000. On average, more than 1,500 U.S. residents are dying of COVID-19 each day. In California, the Los Angeles Board of Education is expected to pass a measure today that would make L.A. the first major U.S. city to mandate COVID vaccines for in-person students 12 and older. In Florida, a judge has ruled for a second time in favor of parents who successfully challenge Republican Governor Ron DeSantis's ban on local school districts ordering mask mandates. The ruling came as the American Academy of Pediatrics reported COVID-19 cases among U.S. children surpassed 250,000 for the first time since the start of the pandemic. Nearly 2,400 children were hospitalized in the week leading up to last Tuesday. Meanwhile, a preprint study by Columbia University researchers published in Nature estimates over 100 million U.S. residents had a coronavirus infection at some point in 2020. That's nearly a third of the population and about five times as many cases as the official toll of 20 million infections in the United States last year. Around 200 Americans and other foreign nationals are scheduled to fly out of Afghanistan today for Qatar, as international passenger flights from Kabul Airport are expected to resume. Tens of thousands of Afghans, including many who qualify for U.S. special visas, are still hoping to evacuate, but their fate remains clear. Meanwhile, the Taliban continues to form its government, restoring its Ministry for Propagation of Virtue and Prevention of Vice. The move stoked fears the new regime will again use violence to suppress women's rights and enforce strict morality codes related to dress and daily activities for all Afghans. This is an Afghan student and activist, Fariba Baksad.
The Taliban came, and if people don't get killed in the war with the Taliban, they die because of poverty and misery and because of depression and despair. I am a student. I am a civil society activist. Since Taliban came to power, people have been terrified. People can't understand whether they are dead or alive. They are like walking dead.
In France, a trial got underway Thursday for 20 men charged over the 2015 attacks in Paris that left more than 130 people dead and hundreds more injured. The most prominent defendant is Salah Abdeslam, who's believed to be the only attacker who survived the coordinated assaults on bars, restaurants, a sports stadium, and the Bataclan concert hall on November 13, 2015. During his first courtroom appearance Wednesday, Abdeslam said he gave up his job to become a soldier for the Islamic State. 19 other suspects face charges of helping to provide guns and cars to the attackers or helping to plan the assault. The president of Human Rights Campaign, Alphonso David, has been fired for advising former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo on how to handle the sexual harassment allegations he faced before Cuomo's resignation last month. Alphonso David was the first Black president of HRC, the country's largest LGBTQ plus organization. He previously worked as a legal advisor in Cuomo's office, where he was part of an effort to discredit accuser Lindsay Boylan, that, according to the damning report issued by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James. In Virginia, work crews removed a monument to Confederate Army leader Robert E. Lee near the state capitol in Richmond Thursday, more than a year after Democratic Governor Ralph Northam ordered it taken down. Hundreds of onlookers cheered as the 21-foot statue of General Lee was taken off its pedestal and cut into pieces. This is Richmond resident Charles Ote.
It's been a long time coming. I'm a native of Richmond. I've been here all my life. I'm 60-some years old. And so I've been passing through and seeing this. But to finally come down, man, it's a moment of joy for me because it represents so much of oppression, depression, because who Robert E. Lee represents.
Former President Trump blasted the statue's removal, saying in a statement, quote, "Our culture is being destroyed and our history and heritage, both good and bad, are being extinguished by the radical left, and we can't let that happen. If only we had Robert E. Lee to command our troops in Afghanistan," Trump added, to the bewilderment of many. General Robert E. Lee was a staunch defender of slavery who led the Confederate Army to its defeat in 1865. The Civil War killed an estimated 750,000 people. In Mexico, 17 patients at a public hospital in Hidalgo State died this week after torrential rains caused a river to burst its banks, flooding the area and leaving medical crews without power. Most of the victims were COVID-19 patients who had to be evacuated through floodwaters. In Brazil, a record drought fueled by the climate crisis is drastically reducing crop yields and deepening an energy crisis for a country that gets more than half its electricity from hydroelectric power plants. Officials say water levels are at their lowest level in over 90 years of records.
The water crisis is the direct consequence of the climate crisis, which in the case of Brazil is mainly caused by deforestation.
In the Pacific, super typhoon Chansu became one of the most rapidly intensifying storms ever observed. It's now the equivalent of a Category 5 hurricane, and is threatening northern Luzon Island in the Philippines as it tracks towards Southeast Asia, Southeast China. Here in the United States, the death toll from Hurricane Ida and its remnants has reached at least 82, with 52 of those recorded in the Northeast, which saw major rains, flooding, and even tornadoes. New Orleans has lifted its curfew 10 days after Ida battered the town, as power is slowly being restored to more customers, though hundreds of thousands remain without electricity outside the city. The Biden administration is expected to push for a major increase in solar energy production, going from less than 4% of the nation's electricity use to at least 45% by 2050. Climate activists welcome the news, but said the 30-year timeline is far too slow and call for Biden to follow through on his climate promises by ensuring the $3.5 trillion reconciliation package passes, even as conservative Democrats like West Virginia's Joe Manchin have refused to back it. And in Western Canada, environmental and First Nations activists have been staging a months-long anti-logging resistance in Vancouver Island's ancient forests. Land defenders with the Ferry Creek blockade are calling on others to join them in Canada's largest act of civil disobedience to save the remaining trees, which are hundreds of years old.
Only is it really important to protect these trees currently, but from industry coming in, invading unceded territories on Pashidat and Didydat land, where they're stealing and natural resources from indigenous people. But we also need it for the old growth, because they have the most water intake that they can hold that actually helps climate change and prevent forest fires. And we need that more than ever right now.
Over 800 arrests against the activists have been recorded since April, with police beating and pepper spraying the land defenders. Canada's experienced firsthand the ravages of climate change. In June, the town of Lytton in British Columbia was flattened by a devastating wildfire one day after posting a record-shattering high temperature of 121 degrees Fahrenheit. June's heat waves blamed for up to 500 deaths in British Columbia. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Warren Peace Report. When we come back on this 20th anniversary week of the 9/11 attacks, we'll dive deep into a documentary series that looks at the attack and its aftermath. Stay with us. Charlie Parker, the great Grammy-winning jazz historian and radio DJ Phil Schaap, who hosted the show Bird Flight about Charlie Parker for some 40 years. Phil Schaap died Tuesday at the age of 70. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're both in New York. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, this week marks the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center here in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. We begin today's show with a comprehensive five-part documentary series on Netflix that examines the attacks as well as the response from the United States, both at home and abroad. The film was released just after the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan, and it features a wide range of interviews with survivors of the attacks, U.S. officials, former CIA members and veterans, as well as soldiers in the Afghanistan National Army, Taliban commanders, Afghan officials, warlords, and civilians. This is the trailer for Turning Point, 9/11 and the War on Terror.
It was a beautiful fall morning. There was the loudest noise I had ever heard. And it got dark.
Pieces of this story continue to come together. I've never seen anything like this.
I whispered into the president's ear, America is under attack.
I am convinced military action will not prevent acts of terrorism.
There's before 9/11 and there's after 9/11.
In the 1990s, we were fixated on a new world order that would spread democracy throughout the world.
9/11 brought war home. It made America afraid.
The NSA said, take as much data as we can.
This was the electronic version of an unauthorized government raid on your house.
The United States had to punish those responsible for these attacks.
There was no higher mission than finding Osama bin Laden.
The perpetrators of terrorism only understand the use of force.
They knew all along these major problems that were going to prevent us from winning.
No one even, like, really mentions 9/11 anymore. I mean, that, to me, that's the whole reason that I'm over here.
Any power without constraint always leads to abuse.
September 11th changed the world. Let's think through our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
The trailer for Turning Point, 9/11 and the War on Terror, a new Netflix five-part docuseries. We're joined now by its director, Brian Knappenberger, the award-winning filmmaker, and co-executive producer, Muhammad Ali Naqvi, the award-winning Pakistani filmmaker. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! And welcome you back, Brian. Brian, let's begin with you. This is deep. It is comprehensive. It starts with the attacks on 9/11, but then goes back in time and, of course, moves forward over these 20 years. You were among the last to interview members of the Afghan army, as well as the people who now comprise the inner circles of the Taliban leadership. Can you talk about the scope of this series and what you're trying to do with it?
Yes, and thank you for having us on. I just thought that the 20th anniversary of 9/11, I mean, what we really wanted to do was tell the story, not just of what happened that day, but how we got there and where our response to those attacks took us as a country. 9/11 was one of the most transformative geopolitical events of my life, on the first anniversary of 9/11, I happened to be in Afghanistan creating one of my first films. I've always wanted to look in a big way at the war on terror, and in particular the war in Afghanistan. And so we go back in history. We start essentially with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, in which with the CIA kind of creating a proxy war with the Soviets by supporting the Mujahideen there. We look at the formation of al-Qaeda, the collapse ultimately of Afghanistan into a bloody civil war after the Soviets leave Afghanistan. We trace the increasing violent attacks of al-Qaeda throughout the 90s, and we sort of frame all this with first-hand accounts of people on the day of 9/11, what happened that day. But I think primarily what we've looked at in the series is what comes next. So we trace the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We look at enhanced interrogation or the torture program, as well as the effect of 9/11 on the United States, the rise of Islamophobia, mass suspicionless surveillance within the United States with programs like Stellar Wind. And so we try to look at the full range of what 9/11 meant, both where it came from and what the choices we made after 9/11, where that led us.
Muhammad Ali Naqvi, if you could say a little bit more about the focus in the film, at least in the early parts of the film, on the effects of the Soviet occupation on what transpired in subsequent years. One of the points that the film makes is that it became very common in Muslim countries and among Afghans also to believe that the Mujahideen actually fought the Soviets and defeated them. And this despite the fact that 2 million Afghan civilians were killed during the Soviet occupation. So could you say what you think the significance of that has been?
Well, I think it's highly significant in the sense that we got a chance to explore a narrative beyond the binary narrative of good versus evil that kind of existed post 9/11 and in the Bush-Cheney years. And we actually, as Brian was saying, got to look at how we got to this point. And one of the pivotal questions that the documentary asks us is, why do they hate us? And I think the United States and other powers had a big hand in creating these Mujahideen, in empowering them, in giving them weapons, in giving them a lot of money. So I think no one really appreciated the effect that this was going to have later. And so it was very important for us to definitely feature that and show that in the documentary and, you know, feature subjects like Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, for example, the Afghan warlord, or even Ismail Khan and others, and the part that they played in, well, first of all, defeating the Soviets, and then, of course, the implications of what was going to be the reaction of, you know, backing different types of warlords in Afghanistan, and how that contributed to, you know, al-Qaeda joining up, for example, and the rise of the Taliban.
Mo, I wanted to play a few of the clips from the series because of the timeliness of this. In this clip, Turning Point, 9/11 and the War on Terror, we hear from the soldiers with the Afghan National Army.
The only thing that exists is that the Taliban believe they have won this war. The United States is escaping, and they should be handed the keys to the door of this country so they can come and establish their own emirate.
Even if the Americans withdraw their forces, we are prepared to fulfill our duties. We'll be standing to defend our country as long as there's blood in our bodies. We're not going to surrender our country to the Taliban.
This is our fight. This is my country. This is my people. This is my army. Remember this face. This is not the old Afghanistan. This is the new generation. This is the new people, the new young generation, and the new army.
So those are members of the Afghan army. This is another clip from Turning Point. Former senior Taliban leader Jalaluddin Shinwari and former Afghan vice president Amadzia Massoud discussing what will happen after the U.S. departs Afghanistan.
The moment Americans leave Afghanistan and their forces are not here, international terrorism will come back. And all that investment that has been made in Afghanistan over the 19 years will all be gone.
The Taliban logic and reason is that the government of Afghanistan is the outcome of the occupation of Afghanistan. When the Americans leave, the outcome of their occupation must be destroyed too. and establish a new government that is acceptable for all the people of Afghanistan.
So that is Taliban leader Jalaluddin Shinwari, who was one of the negotiators in Qatar with the United States, and then before that, the former Afghan Vice President Ahmed Zia Massoud. Mohammad Naqvi, if you can talk about the circumstances of these interviews, when you did these, because, of course, now deeply relevant, though they happened before the Taliban took over Afghanistan.
So we were actually filming in outside of the United States. We also filmed in Qatar and Doha, the negotiations themselves. And then, of course, we also filmed in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And Ahmed Zia Massoud, we filmed in, I believe it was November of 2020. And Jalaluddin Shinwari, also we filmed in November of 2020. And this is in Kabul. And if you remember, at those times, the negotiations were still happening. In fact, the Taliban had gained major ground. Frankly, they were quite arrogant during their negotiations with the Afghan government because they felt that they were in a position of power and they didn't really have to concede much. And at that time, I think the U.S. was just trying to find a way out just to exit. And so this was around the time that we actually interviewed them.
And their comment, Brian Knappenberger, for example, Jalaluddin Shinwari saying we will destroy everything the U.S. left in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's so striking to hear that now. It was powerful at the time. And if you go back to that period of time that Mode was just describing, there was a lot of talk about, a potential coalition kind of government. Right. Our interview with him suggested something otherwise, that the outcome of their occupation, meaning the Afghan government, must also be destroyed. Those are chilling words and very striking up against the words of Massoud, who was sort of I think called it accurately, and then also the very moving soldier interviews that we did with the Afghan soldiers who genuinely seemed felt like they could make a stand against the Taliban. So that all, as you can imagine, all of that, those interviews changed dramatically almost by the week right before we published the series on Netflix.
Mohammed, could you talk about how you made the decision to interview people? How did you select the people to interview? I mean, this film has been receiving excellent reviews. It's one of the top 10 viewed series on Netflix at the moment in the U.S. But one of the criticisms that's been made is that the documentary focuses far too much on U.S. voices and only politicians in Afghanistan, not so much victims or survivors of the war in Afghanistan?
Well, for me, this was quite a significant project to work on. I think when I met Brian and Eve, Eve Marson, who's also an executive producer on the series, I immediately jumped at the chance because a lot of my body of work was informed by 9/11. It was a very seminal event in my life. Being a Muslim American and being in New York at that time, it really informed the trajectory of the body of work that I was doing. And a lot of the work that I did do was specifically related to 9/11. In this, I really wanted to look beyond just American voices. And I think Brian and the rest of the team were very amenable to my suggestions of actually featuring some Afghan voices like Afghan warlords, like Gulbuddin Hikmatyar and some of the politicians. But beyond that, we also featured voices such as the drone attack victims in Pakistan and in the KPK region. And, of course, you know, powerhouse member of parliament and women's rights activist Fawzia Koofi from the Afghan government. Obviously, we did feature all those diverse voices because we wanted to have a more robust and well-rounded picture of Afghanistan and beyond even Afghanistan, just the region and in Pakistan as well. You know, how American foreign policy affected them. I would defer to Brian in terms of, like, just some of the editorial things.
Brian, could you respond also to the question of how interviewees were selected?
Yeah, we I guess I would push back on that a little. I think we got a pretty wide range of people interviews in Afghanistan. We were inside the peace talks at Doha. We were, you know, we talked with the Taliban. We talked with Afghan civilians. Some were in Guantanamo Bay. Some were drone attack victims. We tried to get as broad a picture as we could from the Afghan side too, including in a historical perspective, interviewing figures like Ismail Khan and Massoud, and also Hekmetyar, things like that. So I think we tried to get as broad a range as possible in the series, and that actually was a priority for us.
You know, something that didn't get a lot of attention in the United States this week as we come to the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks is what's happening at Guantanamo. The Guantanamo so-called trials. But I first want to go to a clip from Turning Point, 9/11 and the War on Terror, that features the U.S. Assistant Attorney General from 2003 to 2004, Jack Goldsmith, talking about former Vice President Dick Cheney. The clip ends with Mark Fallon, former Deputy Commander of the Criminal Investigative Task Force at Guantanamo Bay.
Going back to the Ford White House when Cheney was chief of staff, at least that far back, Dick Cheney developed a very robust view about the president's powers under the Constitution, especially as those powers related to national security and war. And his basic view is that when it comes to war and national security, the president is in charge and he can do what he thinks is necessary. And Congress basically can't get in the way. And if Congress does get in the way, the president can ignore it. That was his legal view. It was an absolutist view of the president's powers in wartime.
So it's going to be vital for us to use any means at our disposal, basically, to achieve our objective.
That was frightening to me. It was frightening to hear the Vice President of the United States publicly on a television show where he should have been calming the nation down, where he should have been depressurizing. He was upping the pressure, upping the ante. And so I feared that we would do things that would be to our detriment.
So you hear Vice President Dick Cheney, then that last voice, Mark Fallon, former deputy commander of the Criminal Investigative Task Force at Guantanamo Bay. This comes as the five men accused of plotting the September 11th attacks appeared in a Guantanamo Bay military court Tuesday for the first time in over a year. The resumption of the pretrial hearings comes just days ahead of the 20th anniversary of the attacks. The case against the five men includes suspected mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. It's been riddled with procedural problems, including the admissibility of evidence that was obtained under torture by CIA agents. The pretrial hearings, which have been prolonged for at least 9 years, were suspended well over a year ago in February 2020 due to the pandemic. The selection of a military jury will likely not begin until next year. So, Brian Knappenberger, in the documentary series, you interview the lawyer who has since resigned, saying Guantanamo is, you could say, is in outer space when it comes to the U.S. justice system, exactly why these men are still being held there. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed waterboarded how many scores of times, put under sleep deprivation for nearly 200 hours. Talk about what's happening now.
Yeah, so that's a big part of the series. We trace Guantanamo Bay, what the decisions that were made in order to initially bring prisoners there, why Guantanamo Bay was chosen in the first place, what we knew about it at the beginning, and we go through, understand what we know about now, what was going on at Guantanamo Bay, but we also kind of focus in on the military commissions process, which has been a kind of stop and start process over years, which has really been described to me as a kind of Potemkin village sort of setup where you're where people have been this kind of military trial process that has never really worked well. And so the person you mentioned, Jason Wright, was assigned to be counsel to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And he believed he would be able to mount a defense for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and realized that the system was set up kind of against him right from the beginning, and eventually couldn't be a part of it, and kind of in a conscientious way left that position. But it's been ongoing for a very long time. You're correct that part of the debate has been evidence that was. That may or may not have come from torture, and whether that's admissible. But it is striking that 20 years after 9/11, we're still wondering about what to do with the people who attacked us. And I think that's the fact that that's just started up again now kind of underscores that point.
Let me ask you. Go ahead, Nermeen.
No, I was just going to say, following up on what you said, Brian, it's not just that the film details the problems with the testimonies given under torture in Guantanamo, but also a very good background on how people were selected by the U.S. military to go to Guantanamo in the first place, and the problems associated with getting the wrong people as a result of the bounties that were offered. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, it's one of those kind of striking things, that you go back to and you realize, it's so much of the war on terror. You just didn't, you maybe read a press release here or there or a story here and there. But that was one thing that was very striking, how people were rounded up in Afghanistan. There were leaflets dropped from airplanes. There were, that were sort of promising rewards for members of Al-Qaeda, or members, for people that to sort of turn in people, and that was tragic. Ended up being a very, very tragic part of the story, because of course people would turn in their enemies and neighbors that they didn't like, or just kind of use it. It was abused in all sorts of ways, and so Mark Fallon in the series describes it as bounty babies, where a lot of people were just turned over in the kind of rush and the fear and anger that came out of that period of time. A lot of people, innocent people, got swept up and sent to Guantanamo Bay. It's a pretty disturbing part of that story.
And we just have a minute, but Brian Knappenberger, your previous films include We Are Legion, about the Anonymous Hacktivist Collective, and The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz. And that's significant, given the point that Congressmember Barbara Lee makes. And we're going to have Congressmember Lee on tomorrow on Democracy Now!, the sole member of Congress who stood up against the authorization of military force right after the 9/11 attacks. But she talks about how that authorization of military attacks was used not only to attack places like Yemen and Somalia, but to create a surveillance state at home. Can you end there, Brian?
I think the vote that you just mentioned is one of the most courageous legislative votes in my lifetime. To be the only person that stood up against the AUMF at that moment, when the entire nation was ready to, almost unified in there. hunger for war, just shows a leadership that we don't often see. So I was profoundly moved by that, and that's one of the first people I mentioned I wanted to interview when we started this series. She took she got many, many death threats. She said she describes it in the series, the kind of pushback that she got is very, very significant. But she was right, and history has proven her right. I was surprised, very surprised actually, when I asked Alberto Gonzalez if the architect, one of the architects of the AUMF, about it. And he said that we should get rid of it. I was actually surprised by that. I didn't expect him to say that, but it's this open-ended call for war that has brought the United States troops all over the world. It just needs to end. Wars, it's part of Congress, the responsibility of Congress to okay wars. And the AUMF has been a way around that. It's long past time to get rid of it.
Brian Appenberger, director, and Muhammad Ali Naqvi, co-executive producer of the new five-part Netflix docuseries Turning Point, 9/11 and the War on Terror. Next up, we speak with the Yale historian Samuel Moyne about his new book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. Stay with us. Right back where we started from, by Maxine Nightingale. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh, as we spend the rest of the hour with author and Yale University history professor Samuel Moyne. He's just published a remarkable book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. It looks at how the U.S. created a world of endless wars and helped reinvent the rules of war. The book came out earlier this week, just after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, after nearly two decades of occupation and days ahead of the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks and the launch of the so-called War on Terror. Professor Samuel Moyne, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Start off by talking about this very revealing title, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War.
Well, Amy, the United States has been at war since before it even existed against native peoples and later beyond its borders. And especially since World War II, America has been at war globally. But all those wars were brutal in the extreme, and there were no rules prohibiting brutal conduct by design. What happened after 2001 is that in the midst of an extremely brutal war on terror, a new kind of war emerged. And it was one in which, really for the first time, it was important to Americans to see their wars fought more humanely in conformity with international rules that prohibit torture, that limit civilian death. And the worry is that even though this represents a kind of progress, it also helped Americans sustain war and help make the war on terror endless. Even though Joe Biden has withdrawn troops, he's promised to continue the war on terror in other ways.
Samwan, you also make the argument that a more humane war, this idea of a more humane war, has accompanied an increasingly interventionist foreign policy. So if you could elaborate on that, and also the fact that you detail in the book of the role of human rights organizations in advancing this view. Human Rights Watch, for example, which you say initially didn't take any position on war, but then came to support certain humanitarian interventions.
So I would start the story with Vietnam, which was a much more brutal war, illegal in the international system, but also in blatant violation with lots more torture than the war on terror and a lot more civilian death. And there was an anti-war movement in response to it. And the revelations of the My Lai massacre, which were so horrifying, added fuel to the fire of that anti-war movement. But then George McGovern, the peace candidate, really the last peace candidate we've had in this country, lost badly. And Democrats came to learn the lesson, I think the wrong lesson, that they needed to be as interventionist as the Republicans, whom they were fighting for power. And so we see across the later years of the Cold War and into the 1990s, high-minded rationales for American intervention, even though many of these interventions, like the Kosovo bombings, violated the international rules that prohibit the use of force. And the question I'm posing is whether we've forgotten about those rules, even as we've come to focus on the rules that say once you go to war, you can't fight brutally. Human Rights Watch is an excellent example of these, let's say, imbalanced priorities. So when it began monitoring wars in the 1980s and 90s, it promised never to take a stand on whether the wars themselves are unjust or indeed illegal. But they did say they would monitor whether wars are conducted illegally, whether there's torture, whether there's excess collateral damage. Now, it's also true, as you mentioned, Nermeen, that Human Rights Watch has sometimes strayed from that commitment and endorsed some great power wars. But my question is whether alongside groups like Human Rights Watch that we need monitoring the conduct of wars, how they're fought, whether we need to get back some of the anti-war sentiment that was present in American history, at least intermittently before. After all, the laws of war are incredibly permissive. What they allow states to do once war begins is extraordinarily violent, even when it's supposedly humane. And also remember that soldiers die, not just civilians, on both sides. And so our ancestors sometimes said we really need to keep war from happening. And it's that lesson that we've stopped learning in the age of the war on terror, when we've let the humanity of our wars compensate for the fact that they just keep on going.
Well, Sam, one of the other arguments you make is that, and also this is a continuation of the effects of the Vietnam War, that once the draft was ended in the U.S., the military here embraced humanitarian laws of war in an unprecedented fashion. You write, quote, a self-humanization of armed force without precedent in the history of any great power. Could you elaborate on that and explain why that was the case?
So this period of the later 60s and the 1970s was pivotal for the morality of how war is fought around the world. Partly, there were all kinds of new states after decolonization, and they were made up of peoples who'd been the victims of brutal American and European wars for centuries, and they demanded more humanity. Europeans had stopped their, you know, empires and relied on the United States to protect them, and so they were in position to ask for more humane wars now that they were no longer fighting them. Americans, including in the military, understood that military force had to be inflicted in a more ethical or at least more optically humane way, because My Lai was such a public relations disaster for the military. People were shocked before it was permissible to inflict the most kind of brutal violence on enemies, especially if they were non-white enemies around the world. And Americans celebrated when that violence was perpetrated. After My Lai, the military realized it needed to accept some constraints on the way it fights in the name of being able to claim that it was a moral force. And so it was utterly important that even as humanitarians in Human Rights Watch and other groups stop caring about whether there was American war and focusing on how it was fought, so too the military, which wants to keep its missions going, was willing to accept some constraints on how those missions are conducted.
I wanted to turn, Professor Moin, to President Obama's Nobel Prize speech. It was December 10, 2009, when President Obama received the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway. This is a clip from his acceptance speech.
We must begin by acknowledging a hard truth. We will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes. There will be times when nations, acting individually or in concert, will find the use of force not only necessary, but morally justified. Where force is necessary, we have a moral and strategic interest in binding ourselves to certain rules of conduct. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war. That is what makes us different from those whom we fight. That is a source of our strength.
That is what makes us different from those we fight. That is a source of our strength. You repeatedly reference, Professor Moin, this Nobel acceptance speech in your book. Can you talk about the significance of this and the intensification of the drone wars?
So what fascinates me about Barack Obama is that he was a public moralist, and he thought publicly about the moral significance of law in particular. And he talked about it in that extraordinary address, as well as the one 4 years later defending the use of drones. Now, Obama famously wanted to see himself as an heir of Martin Luther King Jr., and in certain ways he was. He claimed or repeated the belief that the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice. But where King had disputed the use of a force when it's immoral, going to war in the case of Vietnam, not just how American force was used, Obama ignored the first issue or justified eternal war, as you heard, and focused on the second, as if how Americans fight would guarantee the moral propriety of the endless wars they're still fighting today. When it came to 2013, he gave an equally remarkable speech at the National Defense University.
Let me go to that clip, because we happen to have it. Yes, in May of 2013 at National Defense University, the one that the well-known peace activist Medea Benjamin of Code Pink interrupted. This is President Obama.
We went on.
And you tell the Muslim people their lives are as precious as our lives. Can you take the drones out of the hands of the CIA? Can you stop the signature strikes from killing people?
We're addressing that, ma'am. You know, I think that the, and I'm going off script as you might expect here. The voice of that woman is worth paying attention to. Obviously, I do not agree with much of what she said. And obviously, she wasn't listening to me in much of what I said. But these are tough issues. And the suggestion that we can gloss over them is wrong.
And that audience member, I dare say he knew exactly who she was, Code Pink's Medea Benjamin. If you had trouble hearing, saying thousands of Muslims that got killed, will you compensate the innocent families? That will make us safer here at home. She said, I love my country. Drone strikes are making us less safe. Keeping people in indefinite detention is making us less safe. Samuel Moyne.
Again, it's such a morally dramatic moment, not least because you might wonder after hearing that exchange, which one of them really deserved the Nobel Peace Prize. But what I write about in my book, because I think that moment was in a way the climax of Obama's presidency, at least, you know, judged as a moment when he was morally reflecting on his deeds. He conceded that there needs to be some control on war. And if you listen to her, mainly what she's asking is for less inhumanity. What's amazing is that Obama himself goes on in the speech to say, maybe the problem is not so much the brutality of the drones, but that we're fighting endless war at all. Because, he says, these kinds of wars will have effects not just on our victims, but on the perpetrators, too. And he anticipated, I think, in that address, if you read it, the coming of Donald Trump as a kind of consequence of what happens when nations fight endless war. And sadly, we're still doing it.
We just have a second, Sam, but could you elaborate on that? Why is Trump an effect of that endless war?
Well, so as Spencer Ackerman and so many others have written and talked about on your show, wars fought are never without consequences for the states that fight them, even though, of course, we should be concerned first and foremost about those who die or those who are merely surveilled and haunted by drones and special forces. This really matters because it's essential that when Biden gave his two speeches the other week defending the pullout from Afghanistan, he made utterly clear that while giving up on failed counterinsurgency, he's turning to, and maybe will intensify himself, the real fruit of 9/11, which is kind of endless counterterror, no matter what the constraints of international law say, unless they require the drones to strike or the special forces to visit with care for the victims.
Samuel Moyne, I want to thank you for being with us. His new book, Humane, How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War, professor of law and history at Yale University. Tomorrow, Congresswoman Barbara Lee. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.